Good afternoon. My name is Cliff Hale. I'm Associate Medical Director at State Farm and the moderator for today's audio seminar provided by the American Academy of Insurance Medicine. Everyone should have a copy of the PowerPoint slides to follow along. These were mailed out to you earlier in the week by AIM. All of the lines are going to be muted at the start of the call, so if anyone has a question, they should jot it down, and following the presentations, we'll open up the lines for questions. On behalf of the American Academy of Insurance Medicine, it is my pleasure and privilege to introduce Dr. Cliff Titcomb. Dr. Titcomb is the Chief Medical Director for Hanover Re and President-elect of the American Academy of Insurance Medicine. He's board certified in internal medicine and insurance medicine, and over his 25 years of experience in the industry, he has been heavily involved in the creation of life insurance manuals for the Lincoln Re Company and ING Re. He is currently revising and developing the Ascent Manual at Hanover Re. In addition, Dr. Titcomb has written extensively for life insurance publications and is a frequent speaker at underwriter and medical director conferences, both regionally and nationally. His presentations are highly respected for their content, organization, and clarity. Today's topic, opioid use and medical marijuana, a review of the data and an approach to underwriting, is a timely subject as more states legalize medical marijuana and the number of accidental deaths due to prescription opioid use reaches epidemic proportions. So with that and some imaginary applause in the background, I introduce Dr. Cliff Titcomb.
Well, thank you, Cliff. My other brother, Cliff, as I'm fond of saying. I appreciate the offer to speak and enjoy, obviously, speaking with AIM people and at AIM meetings. Today's presentation is really kind of two parts. First part's on opioids and the second part on marijuana. And there's a little bit of overlap between the two. If you're looking for absolute stone cold answers and absolute ideas of what to do on each one of these cases, you might want to hang up and just do something else. What I'm going to try and do is go through the data that I could come across, kind of construct, as I see it, the risk profile for each of these types of situations, and then a thought process of how to think through the cases. I think both of these areas challenge the true art of medicine and underwriting, and that you really kind of have to look at the whole picture in both of the situations. I'm going to skip ahead here to the disclaimer. And go on to the first slide, slide number three in your group. And so when I first did this presentation, the moderator for the talk was asking me, well, does pain itself lead to mortality? And it's interesting, there were a few studies that were done in the late 90s and the early 2000s that looked at the question. And one of the studies said, yeah, there is an increase in all-cause and cardiovascular mortality related to pain. The problem with the study was that it didn't control for other factors such as lack of exercise, other medication use, other psychiatric and medical conditions. And several other studies looked at the same question and did control for those things. And in the univariate data, it did show, or those studies did show, that there was an increase in all-cause cardiovascular and in some cases cancer mortality. However, when you controlled for the other factors, the physical activity, the smoking, the psychiatric and medical conditions, those effects dropped out. And it looked like pain itself does not cause increased mortality. And that includes pain from joints, regional pain like back and neck pain, and also generalized pain disorders like fibromyalgia. On to the next slide. But chronic pain is associated with an increased risk of suicide. There's an increased risk of suicidal ideation, an increased risk of suicide attempts, and about a doubling of the risk of completed suicide, most of which is due to drug overdoses. So there is some increased risk of suicide associated with pain. and the first factors for this on the next slide. Some of them are generic to suicide itself, so a family history of suicide, previous suicide attempt, female sex, presence of comorbid depression, but there are also some characteristics of the pain that increases the risk of suicide. One is the type of pain. Some studies have shown an increased risk with migraine, with aura, and with abdominal pain in one Hispanic group paper that was published. But other factors such as the high pain intensity, long duration of pain, the presence of insomnia associated with the pain also increased risk, and particularly if there's a feeling expressed by the patient of helplessness or hopelessness associated with the pain. So in cases where you might come across that, those would be a bit of a red flag that there may be a suicide potential in that applicant. And this slide just illustrates from one of the studies that was looking at, you know, the increased risk of passive suicidal ideation, active suicidal ideation, current plan, and a previous suicide attempt. So there is some increased risk of suicide, but that's not why opioid use and chronic pain are a problem. Most of the deaths with chronic pain occur secondary to accidental drug overdoses, most often with the opioid medications. So it's not suicide that's killing the applicants. It's the pain and the medicines used to treat it, especially the medicines used to treat it. Well, what changed with opioid use in pain management? When I was in training, we never used opioids for open-ended pain management. There had to be a clear endpoint. You had to have, there's a cancer patient, someone post-op, someone who had an acute injury, etc. Well, in 1997, both the American Society of Anesthesiologists and the American Academy of Pain Medicine said, well, there's a lot of pain out there. We're not treating it adequately. We should be using more opioid pain medication. The Federation of State Medical Boards also agreed with that position and advocated more aggressive use of opioids to treat pain. As a result, and not surprisingly, the per capita retail purchases of opioids increased dramatically, and with it, with a marked increase in opioid overdoses and deaths. Next slide, which is number 9. You can see the increase in retail purchases of opioids that occurred between 1997 and 2007. Methadone went up 13 times, oxycodone 9 times, hydrocodone 4 times. Next slide. Accidental, and this increase in opioid use is reflected in accidental drug overdoses and overdose deaths. The accidental death rate in the U.S. was at its lowest level at nadir in 1992. Since that time, rates have steadily increased, which have been driven primarily by drug overdoses, primarily by prescription drugs, primarily by opioids, perhaps in combination with benzodiazepines. And to the point that accidental drug overdoses have now surpassed motor vehicle accidents as the number one cause of accidental death in the U.S. So as I've told underwriters, if you're going to sweat the MVR reports, you ought to be thinking about opioid use and chronic pain management from an underwriting perspective. And it turns out that the majority of those people that are having the overdoses and the overdose deaths are in fact being treated for pain. About 50 to 80% of individuals with prescription drug overdose are under treatment for pain. And the people that die, it's an interesting profile. They tend to be middle-aged, Caucasians, and living in suburban areas, small towns, or rural areas. It's not the profile you would classically think of opioid overdoses, which classically has been inner-city, non-Caucasian, urban young individuals. So in many ways, it's the baby boomers that are driving this overdose epidemic with opioids. And a couple of opioid concepts here on slide 12. One is tolerance, the concept that you need to, as your exposure to a drug continues, you need bigger and bigger doses to produce the same effects. And also the concept of withdrawal, where you have physical dependence on the drug, and if you reduce the dose or remove the drug, you are going to develop reliably physical symptoms. and they're listed here: diarrhea, sweating, fatigue, and I'm sure you're all familiar with them. So clearly, if you obviously reduce the dose or stop the opioids, you're going to get withdrawal. Go on to the next slide. But physical dependence does not mean addiction. The addiction is really characterized in psychiatric terms by the four C's: lack of control of use of the drug, a compulsive use of the drug, continued use despite the fact that there's clear-cut harm occurring, and a craving for the drug. So it's really the four C's that drive the concept of addiction to the drug. And really, when you're looking at applicants or potential insureds, what you really want to be looking for is whether the individual is pain-centric or drug-centric, if they've got chronic pain. Pain-centric people are focused on the pain. They want to get rid of the pain. They'll do whatever it takes to get rid of the pain. So they'll use acupuncture. They'll use stimulators. They'd stand on their head and spin like a top if it would make the pain go away. Drug-centric people want a drug, a specific medicine usually at a fairly specific dose, and they usually set up scenarios where they can't take anything else or they can't take lower doses, et cetera. So it's important to look for that if you can find it in files. If you look at the risk factors on the next slide for dependence, they include younger age, male sex, smokers, unmarried status, not surprisingly, a past history of some type of substance abuse, even if it's not opioids. But if it was opioids, that's a huge red flag. And then there's a family history of substance abuse is also somewhat of a red flag. Concomitant psychiatric disorders, particularly depression and especially post-traumatic stress disorder, which I'll talk about in a second. A history of childhood sexual abuse in women has been associated with increased opioid dependence, and an increased duration of use is associated with a higher risk of dependence. On the next slide, but you don't need to be dependent or addicted to misuse the opioids. You can still screw up and kill yourself even if you're neither abusing it or dependent. I mean, if you're not dependent on it or addicted. Signs of abuse, things that would be big red flags if they're showing up in an APS, is one, doctor shopping, getting prescriptions from multiple physicians for opioids. Although theoretically, and I think it can occur in some circumstances, you could get opioids for an orthopedic surgeon, for example, if someone had back pain and then go to the dentist and have the wisdom teeth pulled and get another prescription for another opioid. So in theory, you have to look at the case closely. In general, it's a red flag, but in certain circumstances, it could be plausible. Pharmacy shopping, on the other hand, is almost always going to be due to substance abuse. Someone is trying to avoid someone tracking what drugs they're taking. So if you come across that in your pharmacy database, if by any chance, or other things, other notes in the file, that would be a huge red flag. Filling prescriptions early, the dog ate the prescription, I inadvertently flushed it down the toilet, etc. Once, maybe, more than once, I don't think so. Reluctance, again, to use other forms of pain control, so someone who's drug-centric. If there's any indications in the file of bullying or abusing the medical staff trying to get drugs, that's, again, a red flag. And presence of a psychiatric condition, especially PTSD. It's funny, PTSD, I don't talk about it much in this talk, but I've done another presentation on depression. And if you look at PTSD alone, if you control for other comorbid conditions, it's not associated with all-cause mortality or with suicide, surprisingly enough. On multiple studies, I came across that. But it is associated with a proclivity towards having chronic pain and also a predisposition to abusing opioids. And this next slide, on number 17, illustrates some of the increased risk associated with opioids and PTSD. There's a greater chance of using higher doses, longer duration of use, using multiple opioids, getting early refills, which we already said was a red flag, and especially problematic is the concurrent use of sedatives, especially benzodiazepines. This will come up in the next few slides multiple times. Benzodiazepines combined with opioids is really not a good thing. They both have respiratory depressant effects, and they, in combination, are highly associated with bad overdoses and death. This next slide, number 18, illustrates that as you add in more risk factors for dependence, the risk climbs substantially. I'm not going to go through all the factors on this slide, but you can see as you add more and more things, the chances are that person's going to become dependent or have potentially an overdose or death is significantly increased. Now, one thing that's vexing for underwriters is what do they do when someone's on multiple opioids? And one way to address that is using the concept of morphine equivalents. All of the opioids are given a relative potency relative to morphine. Morphine, by definition, is given a relative potency of 1. And then the other opioids are given relative a potency relative to that standard of 1. So by taking the number of milligrams of the alternative opioids, multiplying it times the relative potency, and then adding them all up, you can get the morphine equivalent dosage for that individual for the day. The next slide, number 20, illustrates this potency concept with the various opioids. Morphine, again, is arbitrarily given the potency of 1. Codeine is relatively not very potent at 0.15. Oxycodone, approximately 1.5. And methadone is a potency of 3. And I'll talk more about methadone in a few minutes. But you have to remember, there's no universally accepted definition of a high dose of morphine by equivalent standards, morphine equivalent standards. Why? Primarily because of the concept of tolerance. Someone who's been on chronic high-dose opioids for a long time can almost tolerate industrial doses. If you gave that same dose to a novice, you'd kill them. So it really kind of highly depends on the individual, how long they've been on the opioids and what dose they've been taking as to what's high for them. And I don't mean high getting high, I mean high in terms of the dosage. But it's pretty clear on the next slide that the risk of overdose and death increases with the opioid dosage. This next slide on number 23 illustrates this case from a study that was done in the Pacific Northwest at an HMO. And what they looked at was the morphine equivalent dose of opioids per day, and then the risk of overdose deaths, or overdose events, I should say, and serious overdose events. And you can see, as the morphine equivalent dose increases, the likelihood of events goes up substantially. Once you get to a morphine equivalent dose of 100 or more per day, the chances of an overdose event increase substantially. And this is borne out on the next slide, which actually looked at overdose deaths. This was a study out of the medical examiner's office in New Mexico. And they looked at the overdose death rate by, again, the morphine equivalent dose per day. And you can see as the morphine equivalent dose increases, the risk goes up. And when you hit 100, it really climbs substantially. So you really want to be paying attention to the overall dose per day. Now, not looking at dependence, but looking at overdose mortality, the red flags are, again, male sex and smoking. But rather than young age, it's middle age. It's the older individuals that are the ones that are primarily dying. It's the baby boomer generation, unfortunately, my generation, that's dying of the overdose deaths. And again, Caucasians, the presence of a concomitant psychiatric condition, especially the ones listed there, PTSD being a particular red flag. Use of sedative hypnotic drugs, as I mentioned, the benzodiazepines combined with the opioids is a bad combination. Both are respiratory depressants. People tend to use them loosely, particularly the benzodiazepines. And it's not uncommon for people to just kind of pop an extra pill when they think they need to. And sometimes what happens is these people just kind of wake up dead. They take a little extra, and they go to sleep, and they just don't wake up. Use of methadone is another red flag, and I'll talk more about it in detail. Use of fentanyl also is associated with a higher risk of opioid death. And any suggestion that you're combining opioids and alcohol is a huge red flag, and I would look at that very adversely from an underwriting perspective. Any evidence of significant marijuana use, particularly marijuana abuse, is associated with an increased risk of opioid overdose and death. More than one opioid prescription, again, using multiple drugs, greater chance of miscalculating and getting a little too much, especially if you go out and have a few drinks, especially if you're using sedative hypnotic drugs. Again, as I mentioned before, doctor shopping or pharmacy shopping are huge red flags, particularly the pharmacy shopping. Many states now, particularly states on borderline areas where people can cross over from one state to another, have started using combined pharmacy tracking systems to keep track of how many prescriptions people are getting. And then be particularly careful about periods of time when there are changes in the drug regimen. So someone starting on opioids for the first time, someone who's been on opioids at high doses and then detoxed or were off them for some reason for a period of time and now maybe going back to them, and particularly switching from one drug to another, particularly switching to methadone from another opioid. Part of the reason why someone's been on a period of abstinence is difficult or problematic is because those individuals very well may have been tolerant and they've been abstinent now for a while. Then they try to go back to the drugs and they may try to take the dose they were taking, except they're no longer tolerant. And again, they may wake up dead just from having taken a dose that can no longer tolerate. Probably a case example. I'm not sure if this actually was the mechanism, but I strongly suspected it was this guy Corey Monty from the show Glee, who had a long history of substance abuse, detoxed, was clean for a few months, and then OD'd a few months after that. And I strongly suspect he had tolerance, then went back to an old regimen and didn't tolerate it any longer. Go on to the next slide, which is number 27. This slide just illustrates where the deaths are occurring with the prescription drug overdose by age. And you can see it's primarily in the Middle Ages is where most of the deaths are occurring, or the majority of the deaths are occurring. The next slide illustrates, it was an interesting study. They looked at people being drug tested who were being managed in pain clinics. So it was six different states, 31 different clinics, over 10,000 people, and they were drug testing them on a regular basis to see what else they were using. And not surprisingly, a lot of them showed up positive for opioids, fentanyl and methadone, because they were being managed in a pain clinic. But about 9% were positive for cannabinoids or marijuana, and about almost 22% were positive for the benzodiazepines. So a sizable number, almost a fifth, a little bit more than a fifth of individuals being managed for pain were also using the benzodiazepines. The next slide shows the risk of overdose death by the type of opioid, and methadone, unfortunately, leads the league with the highest risk, fentanyl second, hydromorphone and codeine, oxycodone following behind. And again, medication-related accidental overdose death by hazard ratios by the psychiatric condition underlying, and I have green circles there around the two I wanted to illustrate. Not surprisingly, the other ones there, major depression, schizophrenia, alcohol abuse. You wouldn't be someone with an opioid abuse disorder, and you wouldn't be too shocked that they're actually having accidental drug overdoses. But there's a significant increase in someone with PTSD and also marijuana abuse disorder combining with the opioids. It significantly increases the risk. Next slide. And methadone, like I said, is particularly problematic in terms of overdose death. It only represents about maybe 4 to 18% of all the prescriptions, but nearly 40% of the deaths. And methadone, is used for pain for some legitimate reasons. There's some clear advantages. It has a long duration of action, so it's good for chronic pain management. It's relatively low cost, and it comes in oral form, including a liquid form, so it's easy to take. The disadvantages are, number one, the increased potency. It's three times as potent as morphine on a milligram per milligram basis. The big problem is its long and unpredictable half-life. It has a really unpredictable half-life, and you have to be very experienced with using it to use it effectively. It can be used effectively, but somebody who's using it has to be experienced with it. The physician definitely has to be, and the patient has to be very careful with it, because it can accumulate rapidly. A lot of users of opioids are used to, well, they're having a little extra pain, you pop an extra OxyContin, an extra Tylenol number 3, whatever you're using, and you can get away with it. You try that with morphine, you don't get away with it because it accumulates. If you remember Anna Nicole Smith, who herself subsequently died of a drug overdose, but she was in a hospital in Bermuda or somewhere in the Bahamas, somewhere in the Caribbean, and her son was visiting her, and he actually died in her hospital room, and he had just been switched to methadone. So you got to be really careful with methadone, especially if someone's being switched to methadone, until they've got a real good track record that they know how to use it, and the doctor that manages them knows how to use it. The combination, again, with benzodiazepines is particularly important. And the other thing that's interesting about methadone, I didn't realize until I did research this topic, but it can cause the torsade de pointe ventricular tachycardia, although that appears to be a minor player in the deaths related to methadone. Most of the deaths are related to the respiratory depression. Next slide. Again, red flags for methadone. You never use it for acute pain, breakthrough pain, or on a PRN basis. It's not the drug of first choice, so most people should be switched to it. You also, I didn't mention on this slide, but you basically should also think, is this person getting detoxed from opioids with methadone? Is that part of the equation, or are they just using it for chronic pain management? And you have to, again, as I mentioned before, be special caution if someone's being switched to methadone or if they're using benzodiazepines in association with it. It's a really bad combination. So I've kind of hung the crepe. What would be cases that I think would be good cases from a pain management standpoint where someone's taking opioids? Ideally, you'd like to see them in a low dose of opioids. But it may not be practical. You'd like to see at least that they're on a stable dose over time and they're compliant with it. You're not getting any hints that there's drug seeking behavior in the file. There's no early refills. Ideally, you'd like to see someone who's willing to use alternative means of controlling pain. You'd like to see him followed by a pain specialist, although I say that a bit tongue in cheek, because some pain specialists, from what I've seen, are more like pill mills. They'll just pass out whatever pill you want and see you next time. Thanks for coming. You'd like to see no psychiatric comorbidity, but if there is any, it should be longstanding, mild, and well-controlled, and the person's compliant with treatment. Again, ideally, you'd like to see no benzodiazepines. If they are any benzodiazepines, the opioid dose and the benzodiazepine dose should be very stable, and you'd like to see that you've got extensive track record that they're using the drugs appropriately. I'd still consider it a red flag from the standpoint of risk. I certainly wouldn't consider them the lowest risk. You'd like to see the person functional at home and work with their pain despite the drugs that they're using. Again, good compliance with therapy and regular follow-up. So again, it's hard to come up with, like, these people are absolutely good, these people are absolutely bad. A lot of it is looking at the gestalt of the whole case, the feel of the whole case, and particularly the flow of events. Are they compliant, stable, and in a baseline, a sign waving around a stable baseline? Or do you have really wide swings? Those people I'd be very careful with. The final pearl is on slide, I don't know what the slide number's on here, but so the final pearl is, 2/3 of patients who saw a physician in the month before their overdose death. So these people are, most of them are being followed. They're being followed regularly. They're just screwing up somewhere along the line and then they're dying. And like I said, it's not dramatic. They just are there and then they're not. They don't wake up one day. Next topic is medical marijuana. Now, marijuana is derived from the plant Cannabis sativa. The marijuana is actually from the crushed leaves, flowers, and stems of the plant. Hashish is really the concentrated resin, which can actually be in a liquid form or in a more dried format. Marijuana actually contains more than 460 active chemicals and about 60 different cannabinoids. The two major players from a practical standpoint are delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinol, or THC, which I think most of you are familiar with, which is really the psychoactive ingredient. And it varies in its potency in terms of what the cannabis plant you're talking about. So the amount of THC in a marijuana plant isn't necessarily the same from one plant to another. In fact, the average THC content has increased over time with cultivation. So in 1980, it was about 2%, 1997, 4.5%. In studies in 2006, it was about 8.5% on average. Cannabidiol is another cannabinoid that's in there, but it has more peripheral effects and is actually the drug that does a couple of things. It may counteract some of the THC psychoactive effects, but it also is probably responsible for some of the other therapeutic effects that marijuana may have, such as anti-inflammatory effects, anti-emetic effects, et cetera, pain effects. In terms of historical aspects, marijuana was first used medically in Central Asia and China, and use goes documented back to at least 5,000 years ago. In the 1830s, an Irish physician named W.B. O'Shaughnessy wrote a paper where he actually advocated its use for medical conditions, specifically pain, vomiting, convulsions, and spasticity, which is ironically similar to the reasons why it may be used medically now. In 1854, it was listed in the U.S. dispensary. In 1937, the Marijuana Tax Act essentially eliminated its use for medical purposes. In 1942, it was then taken off the dispensary, the U.S. dispensary. In 1970, the U.S. Congress, acting on its own, declared marijuana to have no medical value and declared it a designated Schedule I drug, which means it has high abuse potential and no legitimate medical use. And so it was lumped in with the same class with heroin, Quaaludes, and things like LSD. And they actually, the Congress in that time when they did that, they actually bypassed the usual procedures for the Controlled Substances Act. And then in the late 90s, data started coming out about potentially using marijuana for medical use. Let's go on to the next slide, which is number 39. So in 1996, California became the first state to permit the medical use of marijuana. Right now, or at least as of mid-April, when the last time I checked, there were 21 states and the District of Columbia that had laws permitting the use of medical marijuana in some form. The laws kind of vary in structure. Most establish a patient registry, so the patient has to actually get a card and be registered. Some, but not all, have allowed dispensaries. But most of the laws are relatively vague about the conditions that can be treated, and often they do not specify that you need a prescription, but you don't need to necessarily have any ongoing relationship with a physician. There's about 12 states that still have pending legislation at this time, or at least again in mid-April. And interestingly enough, Colorado, so most of you are aware, Colorado and Washington effectively voted to legalize the use of recreational marijuana in November of 2012, those laws are now fully in effect as of the early part of this year. The problem with any of these state laws is that marijuana is still a Schedule I drug under federal law. So under federal law, it's still illegal, regardless of what the state laws say. The Department of Justice has kind of danced around that and basically said, well, we're going to consider it, federally illegal, but we'll not enforce that. We'll trust but verify the state laws. So as long as you follow some of our parameters, basically in the states where it's been legalized, we're not going to enforce anything. And the next slide, number 41, and basically they laid out these parameters here. I'm not going to go through them in the interest of time, but essentially, if you're not really abusing the privilege, we're going to look the other way and not enforce the federal statute. But the problem with the fact that it's Schedule I under federal law means it's been very difficult for researchers to study the medical effects of marijuana because it's hard to obtain. There's only one official source. It comes from the University of Mississippi, and you have to apply for an application to the National Institute of Drug Abuse to get some of the drug in order to study it. You've got to write out a pretty significant protocol in order to get access to it. Now, marijuana operates through what's called the endocannabinoid system. And basically, that's a moderator system. It regulates other neurotransmitters at the synapse level. So it essentially functions in parallel and in conjunction with the adrenergic, cholinergic, and dopaminergic systems. And it has effects both centrally and in the autonomic nervous system peripherally. And then there's two different kinds of receptors in the endocannabinoid system. There's the CB1 receptors, which are responsible primarily for the psychoactive effects and are located for the most part in the CNS and to a small degree in the gut. And then the CB2 receptors, which are located only in the periphery and associated with the neuroinflammation and pain, host defense and digestive effects that marijuana may produce. The next slide, number 44, shows the location of CB1 receptors in the brain. I'm not going to go through all the locations here. You can read them in the handout, but you can see based on where the receptors are located, you can see the effects that are well recognized as occurring when someone uses marijuana. So the affecting the appetite centers, so the producing the munchies you would see. So that girl that set up her Girl Scout cookie shop outside the marijuana clinic in Colorado was a very savvy businesswoman. What's interesting, though, is that there's a real near absence of marijuana receptors in the brainstem, which negates a lot of the severity of overdose effects. As a consequence, on the next slide, a lethal human overdose of marijuana has never been reported. The CB2 receptors on the next slide, number 46, are not found in the CNS, as I mentioned. They're located only in the peripheral cells, neurons, and immune cells primarily. And activation leads to multiple actions, the immunosuppression, anti-inflammatory effects, and reduced pain sensation. So it's almost the CB2 receptors that may have some other significant medical effects. Next slide. But marijuana is fat soluble, and it tends to concentrate in adipose tissue. And that affects the next slide, number 48, marijuana testing. The standard testing is usually urine testing. It's the most commonly used format. You're primarily testing for metabolites. Duration when the test can be positive depends on how much you've used and how much you've been using and how long you've been using it. So just one acute use may be positive for 1 to 3 days, but maybe up to a month or more in chronic users, primarily due to the fat solubility with the drug leaching out of the fat stores over time. Blood testing and oral fluid can be used at shorter time frame, so that's why it's not particularly helpful. And you can do hair testing if you really wanted to know. And you could detect back to 90 days, use back to 90 days, essentially assuming the hair was long enough and you had a good enough sample. In terms of the pharmacology on slide 49, the THC is rapidly absorbed when smoked. Peak serum concentrations occur in about 10 to 20 minutes, the peak clinical effect in about 30 minutes, and in heavy users, the absorption may be even more efficient than that. Oral use produces similar physical effects, but the drug is absorbed more slowly and erratically, so the peaks occur much later, about 1 to 3 hours, and levels in general are lower than what you would get with smoking. Because of those pharmacologic effects, and the more rapid onset and the easier titration, most medical users of marijuana, the people who are using it for a medical condition, prefer to smoke the drug because it's easier to get a rapid effect and it's easier to titrate how much you're getting. Again, next slide, going on to some of the toxicology. As with opioids, there's a tolerance effect and a withdrawal syndrome. And there is a cannabis withdrawal syndrome. The symptoms are here, anxiety, irritability, disturbed sleep, GI symptoms, decreased appetite. But overall, the withdrawal symptoms are milder than what you would typically see with alcohol or opioids. And it's felt that the reason why they're milder is because of the fat solubility and the slow leaching out of the drug. So even though someone acutely cold turkey stops using it, they will get some withdrawal symptoms, but they're blunted because the drug, if they've been using it regularly, is still present in the fat cells and still leaching out over time. there is an overall lifetime risk of marijuana dependence that may occur, and the risk is about 1% if you take all users. And again, it's like with opioids, it's characterized by the four C's, you know, the compulsive use, the continued use, et cetera. What's interesting is, though, it's almost unheard of for someone to be truly marijuana dependent if they started using the drug after age 25. The people that get dependent are the people that start primarily in young adolescence before age 25, usually in their teen years, are the ones that can get true marijuana dependence. And the next slide, number 51, shows the lifetime risk of dependence of various drugs, and you can see where marijuana fits. It's there, but it's actually relatively low when you compare it to things like nicotine, heroin, cocaine, alcohol, et cetera. Next slide, number 52. Well, what about the adverse effects of marijuana, physical adverse effects? Well, there's been association in some studies of regular marijuana use with lung cancer. And it makes some physiologic sense. There's about 50 to 70% more carcinogens in marijuana smoke than there is in tobacco smoke, and about a third more retention in the lungs of tar. The smoke is more deeply inhaled generally in marijuana users, and it is usually held in the lungs longer than a typical cigarette smoker. Now, the data on this, the association with cigarette smoking marijuana smoking and lung cancer is somewhat mixed, but the better studies that I've seen, I think, draw an association with lung cancer. There's one study that came out, I believe, in Australia, and they looked at cannabis smoking and lung cancer and found that if you smoked infrequently, less than 20 joints in your lifetime, it was not associated with lung cancer. However, heavy use, 10.5 joint years of exposure, which means one a joint a day, every day for 10 years, so regular heavy use, had a relative risk of 5.7. And in that particular study, they tried to look at the risk with cigarette smoking, and they did control for cigarette smoking and calculate that risk. They drew a rough equivalent of one joint per day, so one joint year of smoking, which is one joint per day per year, is roughly equivalent to one pack year smoking, one pack of cigarettes per day per year. Another study, which is one I just found recently, looked at Swedish conscripts who were joining the Swedish military in the 1968, I think it was 1968 to 1970 timeframe. And at that time, these were all 18 to 20 year olds, and they divided people up by how much they were actually smoking marijuana. And heavy users, they defined as greater than 50 times in their lifetime at that age, at age 18 to 20. And they found, and they followed them out over 40 years, and they found a hazard ratio of 2.12 compared to never users. And they did control for concomitant cigarette smoking, at least at the time they were originally examined. And they also looked at cigarette smokers who did not smoke marijuana and looked at their risk, and that risk was roughly equivalent to about a half a pack of cigarettes per day. And the hazard ratio for someone who was a moderate user, as they defined a moderate user, 11 to 50 times lifetime at the point of being 18 to 20 years old, their relative risk was 1.68. So I tend to think that marijuana, if used heavily and regularly on a long-term basis, is associated with lung cancer. That's my personal bias after reading this literature. Adverse events in terms of otherwise with lung disease. Smoking marijuana increases the blood carboxyhemoglobin level about 5 times. Short-term use actually may lead to bronchodilation. And used for asthma, and was used actually in the early part of the 20th century to treat asthma acutely. If you look at people who chronically smoke now, they have an increased frequency of bronchitis. You'll see increased frequency of inflammation in the airways, in the lungs, and you'll actually see some of the metaplastic changes that are commonly seen in smokers who go on to develop lung cancer. It's part of the other reason I think it's associated with lung cancer. But emphysema does not increase. There is no increase in true COPD or emphysema associated with chronic marijuana use. And this, one of the authors that did that one equivalency in the cancer, lung cancer paper, found a pack of cigarettes per day was roughly equivalent to 7.9 marijuana joints per day, on a, you know, pack year basis. So you basically, I guess if you're smoking that much, you don't really care much about your lungs regardless. You'd be hard pressed to know your name, I think. In terms of the next slide, number 54, there's clearly an increased odds ratio for developing psychosis in marijuana users. The effect seems to be primarily with schizophrenia, but maybe somewhat also with bipolar disorder. And what the effect is, it appears that marijuana seems to unmask the underlying potential for psychosis in people who are predisposed. And the risk is sort of dose dependent. I'll show you that in the next slide. And the risk appears to sort of flow both ways. So people who smoke heavily, regularly marijuana are more prone to developing psychosis. And people that are have psychotic disorders, such as schizophrenia, are more likely to use marijuana. So they tend to go back and forth. This slide, the next slide, just illustrates that any use increases the risk of a psychosis, and frequent use increases it more up into that two ranges I mentioned. Next slide. The risk of chronic heavy marijuana use is particularly problematic in adolescents. Puberty is characterized by cerebral reorganization, especially in the frontal lobes. Any of you who have teenage children or have had been exposed to teenage children know that that is certainly the case. It is a dramatic time of change in the brain and behavior. And developing brain is particularly vulnerable to the effects of the cannabinoids. It increases the risk of schizophrenia, as I mentioned, but if started smoking early in adolescence and continued, it can have persistent adverse effects in daily and weekly users that persists. So memory deficits, reduced attention, reduced processing speed, abnormal social behavior, susceptibility to anxiety, and marijuana dependence, as I mentioned before. The true stoners, the classic movie stoners, would be people who had started smoking early in adolescence and continued. Next slide. The adverse events also include cardiovascular and effects on bone. Marijuana has been associated with adverse effects in someone who's had an MI and then smokes joint. There's a higher risk of sudden death and other adverse effects. It produces physiologic effects, sinus tachycardia, vasodilation, variable effects on blood pressure, but hypertension in some people, sometimes arrhythmia. There's anecdotal reports of cerebral vasospasm, arteritis, cardiomyopathies. So if someone had known coronary disease, marijuana use can be dangerous. It has some effects like smoking. They're also associated with significant bone loss and osteoporosis for women who are smoking, particularly. Next slide, number 58. The effects on driving, the papers on that have been a little bit mixed. Some studies show an impairment of driving skills in a dose-related fashion. But it's highly variable between individuals, in a large part probably because of a tolerance effect. You know, heavy regular users can tolerate smoking a joint with less variable effects than someone who's a relatively infrequent user or novice. The effects, again, on accidents have been somewhat mixed, partly because it's hard to determine if someone has used marijuana acutely. If you're using drug testing with urine samples, they may be positive, but that person may not have been acutely intoxicated at the time the accident occurred. However, there was a recent paper that I thought was pretty good that showed a significant association of marijuana use with motor vehicle combination crashes, and I'll show that slide next. But there's also particularly dangerous is a combination of marijuana plus alcohol or marijuana plus opioids. Either one of those combined is especially dangerous in terms of potential for fatal motor vehicle crashes. This is the slide that was, the next slide here is number 59, the paper I was alluding to. They looked at eight different studies that looked at marijuana and its association with motor vehicle crashes. Along the x-axis there is how the marijuana use was documented, either self-report, urine, or blood testing. And the numbers there are the relative risk. So the overall relative risk was 2.6 And it ranged from, in other words, 7 to 1 study that didn't show an effect. The next slide was another study that looked at the probability of responsibility for a motor vehicle accident based on marijuana use. So the person was drug-free, marijuana alone, alcohol alone, and then the combination of alcohol and marijuana. And you can see, as with the other study, marijuana roughly doubled the risk of having an accident. Alcohol was substantially higher, but if you combined alcohol and marijuana, the effects were synergistic. The outcome was greater than the sum of the two risks individually. Next slide. So in general, the marijuana use is associated with a higher probability of risk-taking behavior in general otherwise in other studies that have been done. The next slide. And now looking directly at medical marijuana, marijuana is not the first choice drug for any medical condition. You know, part of the reason that is the research hasn't been done on it because it's a Schedule I drug. So basically no one's going to go to their doctor and they're going to say, wow, you need to smoke dope for this condition. That's not going to happen. It may be one of the options, but it's not going to be the first choice. Next slide, number 63. Medical uses of marijuana, there's 5 major conditions. So basically severe nausea and vomiting for cancer, chemotherapy, other conditions, weight loss and cachexia, which has been used in HIV, cancer and other conditions, spasticity associated with neurologic disease, particularly multiple sclerosis, where most of the studies have been done, but there's been some papers on Parkinson's, spinal cord injuries, pain syndromes, which is where we're going to see most of the stuff. So it's been used for various pain syndromes, and then also to treat glaucoma. So issues with medical marijuana, the next slide, number 64. Many laws are pretty vague on like what conditions you can use it for. Most of the states don't require, they require a prescription, but they don't require an ongoing relationship with the physicians. And most of the users are going to smoke the medication because it's easier to titrate and it's easier to get a fast effect. And for the most part, like I said, they're going to use it that way. And with the smoked medication, there really is no standard of purity. So you really don't know. It's one of the few medications, if not the only medication out there, where you have no clue what actual dose the person's using. And novice users to it, to the THC, find the effects disconcerting. So an older person who's got back pain, who may try to smoke marijuana, who's never used it before, often will not tolerate it. Next slide, number 65. Most current users of medical marijuana, this is my conclusion out of reading most of this stuff, most of the people we see now in underwriting who are chronic medical marijuana users have been chronic regular marijuana users for a long time, and this is a reason for them to go ahead and continue using their drug of choice. I think there are situations where medical marijuana is a good option. Some of the people with MS, as some of you probably know, my son had a spinal cord injury related to a diving accident and was in a spinal cord unit for a few weeks. And we came in contact with people there who had surgery on their neck, had spasms chronically. Their options for chronic pain and the difficulty they were having was use opioids or use something else. And some of them were using marijuana. And in that case, I thought, it's not ideal, but it's a better option than using the opioids. What was interesting in this one study in California is that they looked at people who were applying for the cards to get the registration. 90% of the people who were applying had tried marijuana before age 20. 90% had admitted to daily or near daily use prior to the application, and 85% had tried other illegal drugs. The next slide. This slide just illustrates the other drugs that they were using or had tried. And so it underscores my point that I think a lot of the people we see who are using it for some vague pain syndrome and have no ongoing relationship with a doctor, they're really chronic regular users, and this is a pseudo-legalization of their use. Marijuana and opioid abuse. Marijuana users are more likely to abuse or misuse opioids. I showed that slide before. They're more likely to use other illicit drugs, more likely to be involved with diversion of the opioids, and clearly the two combined have a very adverse effect on driving risk. And marijuana use, as I mentioned before, I'm just showing it here on the next slide as well. This is the one I showed before. Marijuana abuse combined with opioids increases the risk of opioids. So the next slide, number 69, in summary, most medical marijuana patients now that we come across have been heavy regular cannabis users prior to their going on to medical marijuana. Most medical marijuana patients smoke the drug. Due to the lung function, the lung cancer risk, and other vascular effects, even though I do not think the risk is equivalent to cigarette smokers, I think for a heavy regular user, a five-time-a-week user or more, those people are closer to smokers than non-smokers in terms of risk, in terms of a pricing standpoint. And use in adolescence is problematic because of the reasons I mentioned in the developing brain. So in next slide, when you're looking at the mortality with medical marijuana, it's not the drug, it's the company it keeps. You're underwriting that person's lifestyle and their overall milieu, and whether they're qualified or not is kind of a bit in the eye of the beholder. It depends on your underwriting philosophy and how your risk tolerance. The next slide, number 71, underwriting my conclusions basically underwriting medical marijuana. Like most of the medical conditions for which it's used legitimately are not insurable. The exceptions would be pain and glaucoma, pain being the one we see most commonly probably. Ideally, you like to see the person under the care and regular supervision of a physician. If they're not, it's basically recreational use, in my opinion. No indication or suspicion of misuse of other drugs of abuse now or in the past. I'm not a believer that people that have been abusers can use anything in moderation. So I look very adverse on someone who's had a past history of abuse. Use in an adolescent under age 18, I would consider an extremely high-risk individual. Caution in individuals with any significant psychiatric illness. Again, it's sort of like what I was talking about with opioids. I'd want to see stability over a long time and no complications. Beware of the evidence of any alcohol or other substance abuse. Current use of regular use of opioids is a red flag, both for overdose and for driving issues. I'd be alert for especially for any alert for driving criticism. And I'd be careful with other medical conditions where cigarette smoking would pose issues because I consider them not too dissimilar in those scenarios. So someone with known COPD, known significant CAD, uncontrolled asthma, and a history of tobacco-related cancers. And that concludes my presentation, except for the last slide, which is mortality associated with medical marijuana is not from the drug itself, again, but the company it keeps. So,
well, thank you, Doc.
I know I ran kind of long, so sorry.
Thank you, Dr. Titcom. Again, that presentation had great content, was well organized, and great clarity.